You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this past week. Today, our panel includes Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, Heath Drusen with Boise State Public Radio, and Margaret Carmel with the Idaho Statesman. Happy Friday, everyone.
Happy Friday.
Oh, quick correction. Margaret Carmel is with the Idaho Press.
Oh my gosh. Did I, you know what? And it's, thank you. It is with the Idaho Press. And
Don't you dare steal Margaret away from us.
And you know what, Betsy? I have it written down right. You know why? You know why? I will full disclosure here. I am a little out of sorts because my two children are in an epic fight right now. So one of them is screaming bloody murder outside of the office. And of course, this is one of the days my husband has to be in to work. So I'm going to do my best to stay focused. And if you hear a child screaming, just know that they're fine. It's just when you have two boys at home, sometimes they don't get along. Anywho, yes, Margaret is with the Idaho Press. Okay, so let's start with yesterday, with Governor Little's news conference. And this is where he gave the news that we're going into phase two. And maybe, Betsy, you can get us started with that.
Sure. So phase two is pretty big news, because this is when dine-in restaurants, hair and nail salons, and indoor gyms can reopen. And the governor said 90% of businesses could open during phase one. This brings it up to 95%, but it's some key businesses that a lot of people have had their eye on. So that starts Saturday. The governor also made a surprise announcement that he made two changes to his four-stage plan. And one of those is to move bars up from stage four to stage three. So that would mean that they could open as soon as May 30th if the state meets all of its criteria, rather than having to wait till mid-June. He also announced that for out-of-state people coming to Idaho, the requirement that they self-isolate for 14 days on arrival will be relaxed in stage two to apply only to those who are coming from places where there is community spread of the coronavirus. If they're from a place where there's not community spread, they can just come on in and visit Idaho.
So, Betsy, what I'm curious about that is, did he make mention of how that will be enforced with this, 14 days self-quarantine, or is it kind of like Scout's honor?
Boy, there were questions about that, and the governor didn't really have a lot of answers. The Scout's honor, I guess, approach underlies a lot of this plan. The governor has talked repeatedly about relying on the good common sense of Idahoans, and that most people want to do the right thing and help and protect their neighbors and their communities. Now, we certainly have seen that there are those out there who don't take that view at all. And who, there's even, groups that are on campaigns to try to get people to disobey the public health orders and so forth. But the governor has said repeatedly that the vast majority of people are following, and he expects that to continue, and that there will be peer pressure to comply with the orders.
And then why did he make the change with bars? Did he give a reason for that?
So that was particularly interesting. He was questioned by multiple reporters about whether that was a decision based on science or political pressure. And initially he said, we do everything based on science. But when, I believe it was Jimmy Dawson, asked him, so what were the metrics that you used for that decision? He basically said, I'd rather loosen it up than tighten it up. And it's just been really difficult to tell what's a bar and what's a restaurant. The governor has been holding open Q&As with Idahoans at least twice a week, one with AARP on Tuesdays, one on public TV on Thursdays, for weeks on end. He has been getting question after question from people all over the state saying, how come this business is classified as a bar and this one as a restaurant when they have so many similarities, and why would there be a month difference in when they could open? And I think that he's taken many of those concerns to heart in making this decision. So in reality, I think it likely was political pressure, but it was also a weighing of the concerns he's been hearing from Idahoans.
Yeah. And then Heath, this kind of rolls right into Lieutenant Governor McGeehan, we had the governor on Idaho Matters just last week. They normally have a weekly meeting. Right now it's phone conversations. As the governor said, she somehow is too busy for that now, but she is not too busy to be coming out, frankly, against all of the requirements and the shutting down of Idaho that the governor has done.
Right. And as Governor Little put it in his press conference, as far as the relationship between them, they are on speaking terms when they speak, is I think what he said.
Right.
Yeah. So there's clearly been a split and this has been growing, but the lieutenant governor is now in open rebellion against Governor Little. And obviously they're both in the Republican Party. So this is showing a bit of a split in the party. She raised some questions about the shutdown order, about the stay home order from the beginning, but she was kind of quiet about it. Now she's just had an op-ed in the Statesman saying, and it might have run other places too, I'm not sure, but basically saying that
it was sent to newspapers across the state.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Betsy. But this op-ed was challenging Governor Little's order and saying he needs to reopen the state and saying that, you know, even as going as far as saying, you know, we know that there might be a spike in cases, but basically that it's worth it economically. And it's a real challenge to Brad Little's authority from the number two political elected official in the state. So it's a very stark rebuke. The timing is funny though, because it comes after this poll, like very, very shortly after a poll showing that almost everybody in Idaho supports the order. It was over 75%, and that almost 80% of Idahoans support his plan to reopen, the phased reopening we've been talking about.
And I find that fascinating. Oh, go ahead, Betsy.
Well, the poll also found particularly high support among Republicans. And so it may be that the lieutenant governor's voice here and this voice of dissent is actually a very small thread within the Republican Party based on the results of this poll. Now, this poll had a sample size of 400 registered voters statewide. It had a margin of error of less than 5%. It was conducted by GS Strategy of Boise, and it was commissioned by IACI, the Idaho Association of Commerce and Industry.
It seems that there has been such a loud group from the lieutenant governor and other groups. But this has to go back to the fact that because they have defied the order, they are out. And when we see the polling now that says most people agree with this, you know, those voices haven't been heard because you are, you know, staying home.
Right. And you know, that's a struggle that I've had, and I think a lot of journalists have had, you know, because I do a lot of coverage of groups who are defying the orders. And when you go to a rally, you know, what you can't cover is all of the people who might be counter-protesting but aren't out there because they think it's not healthy. So I think that's a real tough balance. Mm-hmm. Certainly there is a vocal group of folks who are very much against this order, but I think this poll showed that very clearly there is a strong majority of people who support the orders and who are very understanding of the restrictions. So it's a tough balance because you don't see them out in the streets, whereas the folks who are defying the order obviously are much more visible in the public eye.
So I did speak with Alex LeBeau, the president of IACI, and discussed some of the other results of the poll. And one of those was that they asked for favorable and unfavorable views of Governor Brad Little and the job that he's doing. And significantly among Republicans, it was 72.6% favorable, 14% unfavorable. That is a pretty overwhelming majority in that party.
Yeah. And there is something to be said about having those numbers now, right? Because up to this point, I mean, it can be said that it's been basically speculation. So now we do have numbers. And I think that makes a difference. And then Margaret, I want to chat with you a little bit about some of the work that you've been doing. Because you've done specifically, you cover Boise City Hall, and there has been some back and forth with the city of Boise and the state and some confusion, frankly, up until what, Tuesday's city council meeting, when Mayor McLean was basically asked from, I believe at least a couple of the city council members to clarify what her requirements have been for the city. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because they're more in alignment now, right?
Right. So the city of Boise's initial messaging on this was that they set out a similar four-phased reopening plan, but they said, okay, unlike the state, we're not going to put a date on this. We want to instead open whenever we look at the data and the science says it's time to open. And we'll let people know when it's time. And so I believe it was last week, Mayor McLean's office gave some statements to both the Idaho Statesman and KTVB saying, when asked about hair salons, saying, well, hair salons should probably be able to open in the city of Boise by June 1st or maybe earlier, because they weren't going to track with the state and open in phase two. And that, my understanding, is set off kind of a whole flurry of confusion of hair salon owners, business owners being kind of going, or earlier, what does that mean? Why can't we open with the state? And then on Tuesday, Mayor McLean kind of walked that back and said, no, we're going to open with the state when the state opens. And if you went back and if you go back and you examine exactly what she said, she never said hair salons are going to open on June 1st, but she didn't give an exact date. And she certainly did not say the city was going to open with the state. Mm. And it just created a lot of confusion. And it was a really tense moment, honestly, at Boise City Council, which is rare, where City Council President Pro Tem Holly Woodings and City Council Member Patrick Bagent both kind of called out Mayor McLean for confusing messaging and, you know, creating uncertainty for business owners. I get the impression that City Council in Boise got beat up real bad in their voicemail boxes and their emails by angry business owners that were trying to figure out when they could open and how to form a plan.
And now, Margaret, so that has been clarified. Yet I just saw something this morning from the city of Boise where there are recommendations from the state as we move into phase two, but there are requirements from the city of Boise, one being social distancing. That is a recommendation from the state, but it is a requirement in the city of Boise.
Yes, that's correct. And, you know, Mayor McLean is trying to take a little bit of a harder stand on this, especially, you know, with, you know, saying gatherings of more than 10 people are not allowed. And just the wording of the order is a little bit tougher. But at the same time, it raises the question of, okay, the Boise's language is a little bit tougher, but they haven't really been heavily enforcing these orders because Mayor McLean says she's concerned about creating a backlog in the court system by issuing misdemeanor tickets. And so they are going about the education route of sending ambassadors into the parks to tell people to stay away from each other and things like that. But I just don't know exactly how much that tougher order is really going to make a difference, because I was in the North End over the weekend. I was taking a walk around the neighborhood and I saw at least half a dozen parties with maybe 20, 25 people, you know, hanging out and like nothing was wrong. And so, you know, but the city isn't really enforcing that.
Our guest today, Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, Heath Drusen with Boise State Public Radio, and Margaret Carmel with the Idaho Press. And I should note that my children have stopped fighting. So there is always a plus during the pandemic. So Margaret brought up an interesting point about just, you know, taking a walk last week in the north end of Boise, seeing parties. Heath, you in fact put something on Twitter, a picture from Quinn's Pond. And I'm curious to know, first off, I'm to describe the picture. But you tagged the city of Boise in that. And I'm curious if you ever got a response.
Yeah. Well, people had a lot of feels about this, about this photo. I was going to visit a friend at a safe social distance outside, and they live in Garden City. So I was biking through Whitewater, I believe it's called Whitewater Park. That area that's right by the wave on the river. I think a lot of people know it by Quinn's Pond. And I was sort of astonished because it was just jam-packed. The parking lot was full. People were just sort of elbow to elbow. There wasn't even much room on the water. And there was one place in particular, which was the dock, where the dock was completely full with kids. It looked like teenagers. And yeah, they were just elbow to elbow on this dock. And I think, you know, obviously this is not in keeping with the guidelines for social distancing that we are still supposed to observe. And I took a picture, I put it up. I did tag the city of Boise because I was just kind of wondering what their response would be. I did not get a response from them, but I did get a response from a lot of people. Some of them thought that it was a very bad idea to be crowded on a dock like that. Other people, I think no less than three people called me a Karen. Basically saying I was being a snitch. To be clear, you couldn't really recognize anybody and the city's not enforcing it anyway, so I don't really know who I'd be snitching on. But whatever you think of it, it certainly flew in the face of the basic recommendations of the city and the state right now for social distancing. And, you know, made me wonder if this reopening is being misunderstood by some people to mean that this is over, which I think every medical expert would say is not.
And I think that is, you know, the question right there, right, is what are people's perceptions of this, especially because last weekend was a beautiful weekend and we are going to be moving into more nice weather like that. And when all of your city pools are closed, yet Quinn's Pond is open, I mean, it's just, I think, a correct assumption that you are going to then have more people at Quinn's Pond.
It's very inviting, for sure.
Yeah.
Something else I want to bring up is, you know, related to the Quinn's Pond issue, is that it gets very hot in Boise here in the summer, as I'm sure, you know, we're all aware of. But not everyone has air conditioning, and not everyone can afford to turn their air conditioning on when they're home all day, like they might be working right now. And so places like Quinn's Pond or city pools might be a lifeline for, you know, for lower income families to stay cool during the day and the long, hot summer days. And I really wonder what's, you know, how that's going to impact visitation at those types of places or folks that choose to stay home and are dealing with some really intense temperatures because of, you know, economic stress when they can't turn their air conditioning on.
That's I think really Margaret has a really good point, and I was very surprised to see the decision of the city to close all of its outdoor pools for the entire summer, because number one, the CDC says that the coronavirus is not passed in pool water, and number two, it would certainly be possible for them to keep them open with reservations, limited attendance. The cancellation means no swimming lessons the entire summer, no youth swim team, a whole lot of cool down possibilities for kids and adults, not to mention healthy recreation for the summer, have been removed from Boiseans and are forcing people to go to Quinn's Pond instead.
And beyond that, Betsy, I mean, I am on the Greenbelt almost every day, and how many people I have seen literally wading in the river right now. And there is just a personal concern of how many drownings, how many rescues are we going to see on the Boise River and at Quinn's Pond this year because city pools are not open. So,
yeah, Margaret, do you have any insight into that decision? I found that a really, really surprising decision.
Yeah.
I noticed that in the press release, they not only cited social distancing, but also financial concerns, that a shorter season or a limited season wouldn't be financially feasible. But it might be a great service to the citizens of the city.
Yeah, what did they give any info in any of the city council meetings, Margaret?
I only have what's on the press release. I didn't dig too much deeper into the pool issue, but I'll tell you, budget talks have been grim at the city. They are really trying to move money around, figure out how they can take money from programs that aren't operating and funnel it into things that could help with the economic recovery of the coronavirus. And I suppose you could make the argument that pools would be, you know, what would be maybe that public health would help people stay cool and avoid other things. But, you know, my understanding is public pools are very expensive to operate in terms of paying staff to be there, in terms of the chemicals, the cleaning, the water, the insurance, I'm sure. And so my guess is that they chose to close it because of social distancing, but also because Mayor McLean, in her words, she always says, "I'm looking for money." She is, ever since she came into office, and even more so now, she basically has flipped the city's budget upside down and is shaking it to see what sort of savings can fall out, and she can use that for housing, for transportation, or other programs.
And we should note that in the midst of all of this, Betsy, there is an election coming up on
there
Tuesday.
There sure is.
Yeah.
This is a very strange election season. So this year, as happens every other year, every single seat in the Idaho legislature is up for election. And the primary election is on Tuesday, but it is our first ever all mail-in election. So Tuesday is the deadline to request your absentee ballot, and people have until June 2nd to get them mailed in. But it's still, the election still has all the same consequences that it usually does. It will determine who is in our state legislature, a number of county commission races, school levies, and other measures depending on what community you live in. And it's kind of flying below the radar. And so not to mention that candidates really can't campaign. I mean, all the things you do when you campaign, shaking hands, speaking to rallies, kissing babies. I mean, none of those comply with social distancing. And so it's a challenging issue for voters because the result totally affects them. And news organizations like mine, the Idaho Press, have published voter guides in which all the candidates who responded have talked about issues in their own words, and you can read those. And voters can go to any of their local news outlets to find those kinds of reporting efforts before they fill out their ballot at home. And those are all, of course, available online as well as in the newspaper. But it certainly is a challenge, and it takes an effort. And it'll be very interesting to see what the impact of this election is.
One thing I would like to point out is I have noticed an uptick in the amount of people that were emailing the Idaho Press's news email account asking about the voter election guide. Normally, we always do a guide, and it comes out, and I'm sure people love it and read it, but I don't ever hear about it, right? But this year, I think I remember at least four or five emails, which is, again, it's normally zero, of people emailing and saying, "Hey, I just got my ballot, and I don't know anything about these candidates. I want to make an informed vote. When is your guide coming out?" And I remember telling people, "I think it's coming out soon." And people going, "No, but when? I need to know." You know, because people were really looking for information. And we had less resources on hand at the Idaho Press. And I think other news outlets can say the same, to really track down details of the election because, you know, like many news organizations, the Idaho Press, we had our hours reduced due to the pandemic, and we have the biggest news event anyone has seen in 100 years. You know, people were really clamoring for that information.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, and there have been a handful of candidates running for, you know, significant positions like the legislature in the primary who have chosen to try to take advantage of that and fly below the radar, not respond to any requests for comments for voter guides, not return calls from reporters, just throw their name out there and hope they can sneak into office. And so the onus is on the voters to make sure that they don't get something they don't want.
And then Betsy, on top of all of this, then this every single person who has requested a mail-in ballot, because in the state of Idaho, you have to request the ballot, and it's all vote by mail for this election. Tell us what happened about everybody's home addresses and party affiliations being put out there.
Yeah, so this was first reported by the Idaho Statesman that the Idaho Freedom Foundation's Idaho Freedom Action arm decided to post online almost 300,000 Idaho voters' names, home addresses, and party affiliations. Now, the group obtained this information because it is public record and you can pay a fee and get that list. However, it is illegal to use it for commercial purposes or for purposes of voter harassment. Basically, no one's ever posted the entire list online before. And so Wayne Hoffman, the president of the Idaho Freedom Foundation, went on Nate Shulman's show on KBOI yesterday and defended this move, saying he can't believe anyone's surprised or upset about it. And geez, it's public information. If people don't want it to be public, then we just shouldn't have that be public information. Personally, I don't think that the answer to people being upset about what Wayne did is that we shouldn't have public records in Idaho. Clearly, the use of this gigantic set of public records and publicizing it was done in an unusual and perhaps irresponsible way. And in fact, during the course of it happening, the Freedom Foundation initially got the wrong list from the Secretary of State's office due to a software glitch. They got the unredacted list that included all the people whose personal information is not permitted by law to be given out. That's victims of domestic violence, judges, police officers, people like that. Secretary of State's office contacted them. They did take the first one down and replace it. And then eventually they took the list down as they got a lot of outcry from the public about their having done this. And they're now saying that they'll give it out to people on request. And it's true that this is a list that political parties have always been able to get, and they do. They purchase it and they use it for get out the vote efforts. But there's something called, I'm reaching for the term. It's something like practical anonymity, that there's a difference between something being a public record and the entire data set being plastered all over the internet for people to bulk download and use as a mailing list and do commercial mm-hmm. solicitations to. And so Wayne Hoffman's response to this, oh, well, if you don't want to be public, it shouldn't be public. Personally, I believe this information should be public, but perhaps this wasn't the best use of public information.
Well, and beyond that, Betsy, I think there is that sticking point right there of, you know, getting the wrong list. And in defense of the Idaho Freedom Foundation, I am sure that they did not know they had the wrong list. But it was, when you're talking about redacted information, where, I mean, think of victims of domestic violence in particular, and their addresses got out there. And as you said, I mean, that is against the law. So has the Secretary of State's office said anything beyond, oops, it was a software glitch?
Pretty much that was their answer. Oops, it was a software glitch. And when Nate Shulman asked Wayne Hoffman about this, Wayne's response was, well, I disagree with that statute, but we complied. He disagrees with the statute that allows any protected status for those reasons.
Betsy, earlier you mentioned that the governor has been having these weekly meetings with AARP groups, but also on Idaho Public Television. And I believe last night he talked a little bit on IPTV about where the state is in filling unemployment claims. Can you fill us in a little bit about this and what he said? Because we've heard story after story of people still not getting their unemployment checks.
Basically, the governor said the same thing he had said early in the day, which is that they are not caught up. They are overwhelmed. It is a terrible situation, and he feels terrible about it. A week earlier, he had made some comments in a news conference suggesting that they were getting all caught up, and that was clearly not true. And the governor immediately walked those comments back. The director of the Idaho Department of Labor, Janie Revere, was on as well. And she said that there are kind of two separate tracks here. There's regular unemployment And there's this new pandemic assistance program, which is an entirely brand new program, which Idaho had never implemented before and had big problems with figuring out how to do, from the software to what goes through. But they had just, Idaho has just now begun sending out payments under that new program. Payments are already going out under regular unemployment, but any number of factors can trip up someone's claim. And then because they are so overwhelmed, it's impossible to call them on their phone lines and reach anybody to get that worked out. And Janie Revere said that they're trying to reserve the hours of 3 to 6 p.m. now to call people who have issues that are holding up their claims. And they ask that people pick up their phones because, you know, you can't call back. She also said that they simply do not have the staff or the capacity to answer all the calls that are coming in because of the, you know, 130,000 some claims that have been filed. And so they are looking outside their department to somehow expand that capacity. I don't know if that would be through a call center or what, but whatever it is, it hasn't happened yet. So there are still big problems. They're still working on them. Janie Revere also said that as of Monday, they will have 20 new staffers on board at the Idaho Department of Labor. They are training the new staffers. Some of them are already starting to handle claims, and another 8 of them are coming on Monday.
I would like to just jump in here and say something about unemployment. I think I said this on the program the last time I was here, but there is this narrative in the community that because of programs like the stimulus check and because of programs like unemployment and the additional $600 a week coming from the federal government, that folks who are out of work have, quote unquote, more money than ever before to pay their bills. And I have talked to over a dozen people in the last week who are struggling with bills and who are struggling with unemployment, and that just is not true. Some people have gone without work for nearly 2 months and have not received a single unemployment payment. Some people owe back taxes or child support or some other type of payment to the government and were not given their stimulus check. Others weren't unable to get the stimulus check yet because of issues with their taxes or their mailing address. And I really implore anyone out there who is still working or a landlord or someone who has this idea that Idahoans that are out of work are doing better than ever and they just have all this government cash lying around to pay their bills. I tell you, I have talked to enough people that I can say that is not true. And I think that there needs to be more discussion of how these holding back on unemployment checks could potentially cause real disaster, both medical, mm-hmm. financial, and emotional for people.
You're absolutely right, Margaret. And it's such a good point to bring up because bills still have to get paid. Rent still has to be paid. And if you are waiting and you have not had a paycheck for 2 months, that is a huge issue. So thank you for bringing that up.
One more thing, I'll let someone else talk. I spoke with a gentleman yesterday for a story I'm working on about struggles with unemployment. And when I called him and I told him who I was, he started crying. And he sounded like he was having in some sort of distress. And he told me that he has been out of work for nearly 2 months. He has not gotten a single unemployment check. He is running out of necessary medicines that he needs, like insulin, because he is diabetic and he doesn't know what the future holds. And he was begging me to help him. And that mm-hmm. honestly broke my heart because I'm a journalist. I'm not an unemployment person. I can't help. And that's the level of despair we're seeing out there. Yeah.
I want to shift gears a little bit. And because I think this is just a really interesting article that you did, Margaret. And this is how couples are navigating their relationships during the pandemic. And you interviewed quite a few different couples, some newly married. I just thought it was a really kind of fun article. And I think sometimes we need that a little bit right now, especially when we are hearing such stories of despair. So what gave you this idea to go find people, you know, and talk about, okay, how are you dealing with your relationship right now?
To be completely candid, I haven't seen my significant other in 2 months. because of the the pandemic. And so maybe I shouldn't say that on the radio, but what have you, whatever.
Well, are you still together? I mean, there you see, it's working if you're still together.
Yeah, we're still together. We're fine. But, you know, and so I thought about that idea of, I don't know a single person, you know, my relationship is super weird right now. And I don't know a single person that's in, you know, quote unquote, normal situation. You're either trapped with your significant other 24/7, or you can't see them at all. And because you don't live together. And that's, you know, that's something where everyone is navigating this weirdness on kind of a global scale. And I just thought it would be interesting to, you know, to talk to Boiseans about how it's impacted them. And I was really pleased with the way the article came out, because I think everyone is just trying to make the best of it.
Yeah. Well, and it does, it changes the dynamic, right? It's the most time you probably have spent with this individual. And that's what you talked about in the article. So I thought it was just really, really fascinating. I want to thank all of you for coming in today and talking with us. Just so appreciate your time. Appreciate all of the reporting that all of you do to keep us updated. And it's just so critically important right now. We've been talking with Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, Heath Drusen with Boise State Public Radio, and Mark Carmel with the Idaho Press. Thanks, everybody.
Have a good weekend, Gemma.
Bye.
Hey, you too. We'll be home. This is Idaho Matters.